Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. In the golden years of animation, starting in the 30s and going into the late 40s, there was a big call for animated shorts. Little fun clips that would play between reels that would give you a quick frisson of delight or a little chuckle. Disney produced shorts that either featured their flagship character, one Mickey Mouse, or a series called Silly Symphonies, where wacky antics of bullfighters, monkeys, or dancing trees would occur along with classical music or popular tunes of the day. Although they could be zany, these movies were fairly tame for the most part. But if your sense of humor skewed zanier, and let's be honest, more violent, the Warner Brothers Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes were what you were waiting to come up on the screen. Today, we're going to look at two movies, one animated, one live action, that draw from the zanier slapstick era of not just animated movies, but the classic slapstick comedy that seems out of place for the time they were released. Alicia, this is your episode. You champion these movies so hard, and I was so glad to watch them. And I feel like this is a style that you would be so into when it comes to comedy, especially given how much you love these movies.
Yeah, I didn't grow up with either of these films, though, and that's very important, I think, for this episode. I had never heard of Cats Don't Dance until Rachelle Charcot had shown it at the Royal in Toronto maybe 3 years ago. I have no sense of time. It could have been 3 months ago. I guess not. And I was like, oh, what is that? And like kind of read about it. And as we're going to talk about it, it was really buried. And then Mouse Hunt, I mean, oh my God, this was my revelation of the early part of the pandemic when we were all just watching as much content as we could. I had noticed that there were these really amazing virtual screening programs that the UCLA was putting on and a lot of kind of independent cinematheques in New York. And, you know, they'd have the new Romer restoration and, you know, the Wong Kar-wais had come out at that point. And then all of a sudden, like multiple of them showed Mouse Hunt along with these films. And I was like, what? Like, I could picture the VHS covers, like, you know, the little mouse with the olive and Nathan Lane. I was like, why is a Mouse Hunt screening with Pasolini? And then I watched it and I was like, oh my God, like this is a masterpiece. Like, where was this film? I guess I was like 13, so it's not, I was a little, that cusp of like, yes, I loved watching Disney's Hercules and stuff, but I was kind of aging out of classic animation and G rated films. But I've watched Mouse Hunt probably 8 times in the interim, like since seeing it the first time. And I.
Is it because of the evil cat? Although we're going to get to it. Is it because of the evil cat?
No, it's really not. I mean, there is a cat named Catzilla in this. Obviously, if you have a mouse film, you're going to have an evil cat. It's not that. It's just how it harkens back to Laurel and Hardy and how it engages with classic comedy and does the slapstick, which a lot of the reviewers hated the slapstick and failed to notice the nuance and the message of the film, and how it engages with animation history, even though it's not animated. I mean, you know, you brought up Mickey Mouse. That guy has no personality. Like, the idea that this empire was launched with Mickey Mouse, who displaced Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. And Mickey, I mean, tell me one thing that Mickey is. I guess affable? Is that
he is a steamboat captain, and that is the most anyone can aspire
like
to.
But like Donald Duck has a personality. Goofy has a personality, and it's like actually like acknowledged in his character name. All the other characters in Disney's canon of the original animated characters have personalities. Mickey is just milquetoast. And so I love that Mouse Hunt kind of gave the prominence to a mouse character that then engages with Christopher Walken. Then, like, I don't want to spoil it. We're going to get into it. But these are films I didn't grow up with. I totally see how they were made for me, both as a 13-year-old and as a 38-year-old. And I think I'm Mouse Hunt's biggest fan. I have a T-shirt. I know was a generation that's younger than me. So like I'm the oldest generation of millennial. I'm 83. So kids born in more like 1989, 1990, this is their jam. Everyone that I've talked to about Mouse Hunt who's that age is like, oh, hell yes. And I'm like, interesting. Okay, I just missed this generation of mouse hunters.
These are also both movies, as I mentioned earlier, that are very much out of time. Like, we don't make movies, we weren't making movies like this then. We definitely are making movies like this now. And so to see these in 1997, I'm like, these are movies that maybe you would see in like the, I don't know. I mean, these are like 30s, 40s. Like, that's what it feels like. It's not.
It's all, I'd also say, too, what you're saying, Alicia, they're both weird. They're both, like, movies I think are good, but I also can say that they don't quite hit either audience correctly, you know? Like, they're not quite kids, not quite adults, but in a way that I think still works.
Yeah.
But I could see how, like, I could see how you could sit the wrong kid or adult in front of either of these, and they'd be like, what the hell is going on?
I think they're also made by two directors, Mark Dindal for Cats Don't Dance and Cor Verbinski in really one of his earliest films for Mouse Hunt. Made by two directors who understood subversiveness in comedy, subversiveness in action films, subversiveness in animation. And so, I mean, I think I saw Rango well before I saw Mouse Hunt. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is unusual and fantastic. And that's Gore Verbinski's big, you know, other animated film, but CGI. I get it. Like, I think as much as Becky, you're talking about these being out of step with time, and Cam, you're saying they don't quite match, and like it's like a little bit of a square peg in a round hole. That's me as a person, as a cinephile,
as a critic. Yes,
come on. Like, that's just who I am, and I'm not surprised that both of these films hit really hard. And I'm not sure at 13 I would have understood the references to Laurel Hardy, the references to Charlie Chaplin, the references to Gene Kelly, the references to Shirley Temple. You know, all of the cameos we're going to talk about in Cats Don't Dance, I would have only known them from Animaniacs and from classic Looney Tunes, I think.
Totally. Okay, well, let's get into our first movie today. And Alicia, it was perhaps a bit of a miscalculation on how much kids love golden era Hollywood references and Scott Bakula. But Cats Don't Dance was a big investment from the onset, even recruiting one of Hollywood's most iconic classic Hollywood performers to consult on the movie's dance numbers. After Turner's short-lived animation studio was acquired by Warner Brothers mid-production, well, it's often compared to the Iron Giant in terms of quality of film versus bungling of the release. The main reason why people have heard of this movie today is because of its repetitive playing on the Cartoon Network during their youth, and it's become sort of a winky in-the-know gag for animators. In fact, in an episode of Teen Titans Go, which is one of my small person's favorites, the character of Beast Boy explains VHS to modern kids using video cassettes of both Iron Giant and Cats Don't Dance. Now, Alicia, I know you picked this one because of your curation of non-evil cat movies, but Cam, do you feel this holds up on its own? Like, especially in the face of it being released opposite Disney's Hercules?
Oh, yeah. I definitely think I can kind of understand that, like, why maybe it didn't connect. But I do think it's mostly just a botched release on the part of the distributors. Like, you find out things. I mean, my favorite, I'll just burn my good facts. They did, like, no merchandising. And in fact, the only merchandise you can get from Cats Don't Dance was from a kid's meal at Subway.
Which, when I googled photos of them, I was like, oh, yeah, because I lived in Los Angeles in 97. And I was like, I remember those. And I remember, I had a vague memory of being a kid and being like, what the hell film is that?
And I definitely think, like, to their credit, I do remember the Subway kids pack kind of being a thing. But anyway, it's like,
you got a round bun sandwich.
Yes, a tiny sandwich.
Like a milk or a pop. And then I think it came with, there was some dessert. But yes.
We sound like such ancient people talking about this.
Subway.
Used to get a lump of coal and a round Subway.
Cam, before we get too far into the what are we talking about? Like the archives of Subway meals.
Yes. Anyway, that's all I have to say. So,
give us a
Subway
plot.
Is their pathetic merchandise.
They're cute toys.
Yes.
Give us a plot line.
They're cute toys.
Give us a plot line.
The plot line is, as you said, Scott Bakula, Quantum Leap himself, is Danny, the song and dance cat, who moves from Kokomo, Indiana, to the bright lights of Hollywood, which is pretty much the Hollywood we know. It's kind of a Looney Tunes version where animals and humans, anthropomorphic animals, it should be said, and humans live side by side. Danny thinks he's just going to make it, but he does not know the deep-seated prejudices of Hollywood, where animal performers are allowed to be in the background, but they are not allowed to be stars, and they're definitely not allowed to sing and dance as he wants to. So instead, he accidentally gets the ire of a child star, Darla Dimples, who is a fun, evil version of Shirley Temple, who is especially prejudiced against cats.
Who has the greatest sidekick named Max, who has one of my favorite animation character tropes, where they have a huge top half and a tiny bottom half.
Shaped like a coffin.
Yes. Really
like a traditional, like, you know, like Nosferatu coffin.
yes, being essentially the like Eric von Stroheim guy from Sunset Boulevard, but a giant monster version. So essentially he keeps getting tricked by Darla, but he really believes that if they put on a show that's good enough, they can get in. And it's essentially him working with a plucky little penguin to convince all the animals who are jaded in Hollywood, including Sawyer, who's a sexy lady cat, to try again, to try to show how great they are as performers and convince the people that are prejudiced against them that they could be stars too.
Oh, does this all at all sound a bit like African Americans in Hollywood or perhaps any other
there's
race in Hollywood?
There's totally a minstrelsy reference here, which I think is amazing.
I also think that this has the problem of 90s stuff where it doesn't, it's not quite specific enough.
Yeah.
It's like instead it's like, let's talk about the concept of prejudice and kind of that like neoliberal idea of like, well, certainly people are prejudiced because they don't realize they're prejudiced. Like not that there's any sort of system creating this prejudice, because it's like even this, it's like, they just need to perform in front of everybody and then they go, oh, wow.
They're capable of this. They just haven't been given their shot. It's like,
certainly did not happen for African-American performers who sure did perform in Shirley Temple movies and didn't get any opportunity. So, anyway, so it's not the perfect metaphor, but it's good for kids to be nice to each other and work hard, you know.
I mean, this was a movie that initially from the outset was set up for success. Like, you start looking at the cast and there's this great mixture of, like, you know, Scott Bakula, who was a Broadway performer. He sings his own songs. Yes. He's very good.
And they're good.
In this.
The songs are excellent.
Freaking Randy Newman post Toy Story, right? So, like, they went to the best. Yeah. And I mean, the singing voice of Sawyer, who's the female cat, is freaking Natalie Cole. Like, again, we're talking like music royalty.
Jasmine Guy as the non-singing voice. And I actually thought that
also fantastic.
That dichotomy worked really well of Jasmine Guy transitioning into Natalie Cole. And the Natalie Cole songs, I'm not going to lie, I went on Spotify and liked a few songs of the soundtrack because I couldn't get them out of my head.
I may or may not have made Big and Loud my theme song. And even though I understand it's sung by the villain, it is certainly something I relate to and I like it.
I relate to the fact that the villain has dimples because if anyone's seen me, like a photo of me, there's ginormous dimples that I'm rocking.
Ah, oh, darling, sweetheart, celebrity, darling.
Angel? That's right. I am an angel. I am an adorable little angel.
Totally. But I love the fact that you have this like mix of like, again, like modern people, Scott Bakula, et cetera. But then you've also got Hal Holbrook and Don Knotts and like Betty Lou Gerson, George Kennedy. Like these are like classic actors. And although I don't feel that they're given enough to do, I wish there was more. They're definitely recognizable people that I'm like, okay, you really tried to get this great mix of like new and old. And there's something kind of for everybody.
You also have
fantastic.
The middle ground of actors, which I love, which is... John Rhys-Davies, obviously best known for Indiana Jones. And then my favorite, René Auberjonois, who is a pretty small role, but he's like kind of the Frenchy guy. I love him so much. Mm-hmm. Anything he's in, like just looking at this cast list, I'm like, oh man, these are all people. Even the ones I'm like, who's that guy? And then I look at the photo, I'm like, of course it's that guy. Like it's... Yeah. Really remarkable.
Something that I think the animators did really well that was pioneered by Disney in their renaissance is starting to really use reference materials. So like using divine for Ursula and making sure that like all those movements, things like that are very much divine, right? That wasn't, it was kind of done, but not 100% because they didn't have the time, they didn't have the budget to do that in a lot of animated movies. They were just kind of flying by the seat of their pants. This here, they are very clearly modeling these characters on the actors. Like the Don Knotts turtle, of course he's a turtle, right? Like that's what he's going to be. But the biggest thing is that Gene Kelly choreographed these dance numbers, and these animated dance numbers are spectacular. And you see Gene Kelly and classic Hollywood written all over them.
Yeah, like he passes away in 96, right? I don't think I should have checked that. But so he's kind of, he's uncredited in some forms of this film and then credited in others, but he's officially choreographer consultant. So he would have been working on it in way pre-production, kind of like going over how to animate some of these dances. And I mean, they're pure Gene Kelly, like the character that Scott Bakula plays is just, it's a Gene Kelly character. It's a little bit of Danny Kaye, I think, mixed in as well.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, this is his last film credit. Like that is remarkable. And it's important to point out, I think, that before this was Warner Brothers, it was, you know, it's produced by Turner Animation. So it's Turner's company that was trying to get into animation. And then eventually Warner Brothers buys Turner, as we know, and some, I'm probably getting this wrong, but it gets subsumed by Warner Brothers. Yeah. And it feels like if it had just remained that independent sort of Turner animation, it would have been way bigger. It really is that Warner Brothers bought that company for other reasons and then were dropped this and was like, whatever, this is not why we want this company.
So they even, when they got it, they were actually like, well, we can't do something in the 30s and 40s. Let's update it to the 50s. And they were like, you understand this is an animation and we can't just do reshoots. Like,
and also, how far along they were. You hear these weird things of people dropping in and it's like too late. But like you say, it was, I think the thing that makes it work is it was set up so rock solid, like you guys say. Like they started, and another thing is like the along with Gene Kelly, they had this guy Brian McKenty doing the art direction, and he was in charge of the Beauty and the Beast dance sequence, which is like famous in animation for being like such an amazing and fluid dance sequence.
Beautiful.
So I feel like they like set up a best of, and it's worth saying that like Mark Dindal was also at the time, like he was an animation effects guy. Mm-hmm. So like this was his first shot to be a director, but he was kind of considered on the cutting edge of directing. And he's a Disney guy. So.
He would then go on for Empire, The Emperor's New Groove, which
is my favorite Disney movie.
I was going to say, like, I'm not going to say it's my favorite. It is up there. I banged out that VHS, like, and it's 2000, right? So I'm pretty old by that point. But I loved it. Like, just, and I think it's the same style that you see in Capstone Dances there, with getting Eartha Kitt to play one of the greatest comedians
of all
time,
villainous
with of all
one
time.
Of the greatest sidekicks of all
Kronk.
Time, played by Patrick Warburton. Like
Kronk.
The two of them together are so funny, and it's so. I'm sorry, I love that. We'll talk about it eventually.
It's worth saying as well that if you guys haven't ever seen Sting's wife's documentary, Trudy Stiles' documentary, The Sweatbox, about the development of Emperor's New Groove, it's very fascinating because like they're essentially kind of simultaneously in production. Emperor's New Groove starts in '94. This starts in '93. And Dindal was brought in to save the Emperor's New Groove because essentially like Pocahontas and Hunchback did so poorly. Yeah. Emperor's New Groove was this film called, I think, Empire of the Sun. And it was a serious, like, Incan story.
But that's why, right? Because the other two failed because they were too serious and too dark.
Well,
they tried to take it in
the
wrong direction.
I was
going to
say, if you make a film about someone with a disability and don't know what you're doing, and then make a film about cultural racial genocide, also you don't know what you're doing.
It's not going to equal box gargoyles office. That sang and danced. What more do you want?
Sure. And the guy from Murphy Brown. But Kingdom of the Sun was what it was called. And this different guy, Roger Allers, was directing it. And then eventually they brought in Mark Dindal. I think, honestly, it's very hard to tell the timelines because they're quite simultaneous. But I believe that they probably saw Cats Don't Dance, to be honest, and brought in Dindal.
Yeah.
Or at least that bolstered him because eventually Roger Allers left the project entirely and Dindal essentially rewrote it to be what you know as Emperor's
Critics loved this. Like I went through some of the reviews from 97, even 98. Some people weren't seeing it till 98. This was universally beloved and if you look at the nominations and the wins for the Annie Awards, this is a top one, likely because Disney's in a not a slump, but just sort of kind of in stasis, I would say.
This is the tail end of the Disney Renaissance. This is kind of like the end of this.
Yeah. But this was, you know, this really resonated with critics, and that makes sense, right? You hope, I don't think it's true today, but you hope that most film critics have some Hollywood history or some film history, so it makes sense that you're just kind of feeding them their life food, like something that they really love, like Greta Garbo references and all that. But it's such a missed opportunity for Warner Brothers to have not properly released this. And I will be honest, I watched this through the Toronto Public Library. It is not on streaming services. Perhaps that will change. There's been conversations, but we haven't even seen this be offered to us by Warner Brothers. So there's got to be some, you know, and we'll hopefully be able to change that. But as Hollywood Suite, I mean. But yeah, this is still in 97 underseen. And yet there's a lot of great articles that are coming out of people in our generation, slightly younger, saying like this was their jam in the late 90s. Yeah. This deserves absolute like admiration. Why is this not more widely viewed? And I love that we're, you know, I love that on this podcast we get to talk about films like that. And I love as a 38-year-old, I get to discover children's films from all kinds of generations and decades that I didn't know about that would have been my jam back then.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about what happened with Warner Brothers and why this didn't do particularly well, what the botched release was. Cam, I know you did a bit of research on this. Do you want to get into it a little bit?
I think that generally Warner Brothers animation was more concerned with television, is what it is. Because like you mentioned, Iron Giant is also them. Yeah, this feels like Animaniacs, which I think is kind of fair, is why also I think people kind of...
And Tiny Toons.
Maybe you're like, I don't know. Yeah.
Darla Dimple honestly, is very much Elmira Duff. Like, it's really similar to that character.
But, like, and the weird thing is that's not a knock on this movie. It's actually more praise to their television content at the time, I think. And I think, if you think about the other two big features, which are Mask of the Phantasm, the Batman movie, and Iron Giant, it's like, those are amazing. But yeah, they also are kind of, I guess, tied... And just, But anyway, what I know is that they were very inspired by American Tail, because American Tail, not because it's because of any of the creative aspects, but because it made so much gosh darn money. And that's partially why Warner Brothers wanted this animation division. But they never seemed to commit. You probably know more than me. But they just never seemed to commit.
So here's what happened.
You probably know more than me. I do.
No, I don't know why you threw it to me, to be honest, Becky.
Well,
I did a little.
I want to give you a chance. And honestly, you usually, like your corner of research, Cam, sometimes you find like these little crannies that I'm like, sorry, where did you find that? Also, you know how to use the Wayback Machine, which I get confused, lost, and need my mother.
All I've got is the Sweatbox. Everyone should watch the Sweatbox. It's a great documentary.
I'm so in. Okay, so this is what happened. So this was always my question of like, why didn't anyone really try to compete with Disney Renaissance like era stuff, seeing that there was now money to be made in animated features? And the answer is Warner Brothers did. And what they did was they actually put all of their money, all their resources and everything into a movie called Quest for Camelot. And Quest for Camelot was, as you most people have not heard of it, there's no goodwill or good feelings towards it, with the exception of there's some posters of it in a Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode, also Warner Brothers. Weird little piece of trivia. But it looks like a Disney movie. It's got music, like the kind of soaring orchestral kind of music like a Disney movie. The characters are very Disney movie-esque. They were trying to be Disney, and they were trying to follow that formula. Guess what? That didn't work. What they should have been doing was putting their money into these movies like The Iron Giant, et cetera, and releasing those. And they had a huge success with Space Jam, which, of course, was the kind of stuff that people were expecting from Warner Brothers. And I think the interesting thing to me is that there's actually footage of Brad Bird, who would later go on to be like a Disney directorial superstar doing The Incredibles, things like that. And there's all this footage of him just like going off about how they're not Disney. Screw Disney. Disney is all like sunshine and rainbows. We're Warner Brothers. We're violent. We're nasty. We can do all these like difficult concepts that kids can handle,
we'll
but nobody
drop
ever
an
throws
anvil
at
on
them.
You.
Exactly. Yes. And so, and he really understood what the difference was, and Warner Brothers didn't. Warner Brothers was like, we have to be Disney to compete with Disney. Yeah. And that was the biggest issue that happened here and why they failed, because they kept missing what their strengths actually were.
I think that's spot on.
And I think that they were behind the ball, because we just talked about Pocahontas and Hunchback, and Quest for Camelot is quite a lot like those. Yeah. It's those the serious... there's some music, but it's not fun. Mm-hmm. It's not even Little Mermaid fun, which is not that fun. And the other thing to point out is, along with Warner Brothers, many other studios at the time had a branch where they usually did a one-off that didn't connect that hard and gave up. So Don Bluth was with Fox doing Anastasia in 1997.
There's some love for that film.
It's probably his biggest hit. But at least that one is like Fox saying, listen, we have this old movie that you could make an animated version of. And apparently Fox thought for a long time about that, like our old properties. What could you turn into animated movies, which is a kind of a different approach. And then DreamWorks, their first release is Ants, which is weird enough and probably what kept them afloat because it's CGI.
Ants is also an FU by Katzenberg because Katzenberg had just transferred over to DreamWorks from Disney, where he has a notoriously bad blood with Eisner, whole falling out. I think we talked about that in an early episode.
Remind me, is Ants Woody Allen?
That's the one. Yes. And Sylvester
Woody Allen
Stallone.
And Sylvester Stallone. Sharon Stone.
But to
their credit, I don't think Ants was meant to really compete with Disney. Their Disney competition is Prince of Egypt, which is pretty good.
He knew that Bug's Life was coming out, so he was like, we need our own to take some of the money from that movie. So it was meant to undercut Bug's Life. That's why that came out.
Explain to me why B-movie then exists.
Because Jerry Seinfeld gets to do what he wants.
Jewish neurotic comedians as bugs.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is also, it's worth saying that it's Katzenberg, Geffen, and Spielberg. And I mean, Spielberg made his money with Jewish history and American Tale. Yeah. So I think that's partially why they did Prince of Egypt. I mean, it's just fun. Yeah, it's worth a watch is what I would say. I'm somebody who just watched it for the podcast. I've never seen it before. But yeah, I think especially if you have... Like I say, you shouldn't say, I never want to say that it's like Animaniacs or whatever, or Warner Brothers cartoons in a bad way, because I love that there's little, like you see celebrities like they were in Merry Melodies, you know, there's real celebrities in the background, which is fun. And it's you know, it's a tight 72 minutes or something. It's in and out. I will say I found the songs a lot less catchy. I think they're good. I just don't, they're kind of slipped out of my mind, but, yeah, I think it's silly. It's silly fun. And I would definitely put it on in front of a kid because I think that they'll really enjoy
it. Yeah, I think it's a rare case of 25-year-old animation that you could put in front of a child and not be worried about racial caricatures or issues with trans. Like, it really is like, oh, it's probably just by luck and pure-heartedness of these writers, but they didn't do anything mean. I mean, it's meanest to the Shirley Temple character, which I'm like, fair. Sure. The blonde, curly-cued, dimpled megastar turns out to be a monster. Like, yep, that's that.
We
that
all
tracks.
Watched What's the Matter with Helen. We all know the truth.
I thought about that film actually while watching this quite a bit.
She's delightfully evil too. Yes. Like she's pretty good. And they definitely do like weird, you know, Cruella De Vil faces for her. And
it kind of reminded me of Cate Blanchett's character in Nightmare Alley, which I realize maybe not everyone has seen yet, but like evil for just pure evil's sake. No character motivation, like just the embodiment of maliciousness, and also a similar haircut, which I really appreciate.
All right, I think that's where we have to move to our next film. And of course, this is Alicia's new favorite, Champion It. Everyone must see it. That's coming up after the break.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We often refer to movies as being live-action cartoons to describe their wacky antics, but I genuinely can't think of a movie more like a Sylvester and Tweety cartoon in real life than the series of disastrous vignettes that occur in the movie Mouse Hunt. I saw this one as a tween in the theater when it first came out, and I remember thinking, who is this for? Watching it as an adult, I have exactly the same question, but I certainly have more respect for the escalating disaster sequences that are executed to perfection. Let's talk Mouse Hunt. Alicia, plot. Mm-hmm. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, the plot is basically there in the title. it's a hunt for a mouse. So these two brothers, their father, played by William Hickey, who was actually on his deathbed, dies and leaves them his string factory. These are the Muntz string factory. And, you know, the whole estate's basically bankrupt. They do find out that there is this house that their father owned that they didn't know about, this dilapidated house in the country. And because they've both, for whatever reasons, one got kicked out by his wife, the other kind of led to the mayor dying by choking on a cockroach. Yes. Long story. They need somewhere to sleep. So they're like, oh, whatever. We know that this house is available. We're going to go sleep there. And it's, you know, falling apart. It's insane. What they eventually find out, though, is that it was built by a very famous architect, and it's considered the lost masterpiece of this architect. Kind of think like Frank Lloyd Wright, but much more like Art Nouveau, less like craftsman. And they decide that this is the best way to make money because it could be worth literally tens of millions of dollars. They're going to restore it. What they're up against, though, is the mouse that has, it's a singular mouse. It is a mouse. I mean, mouse is, it's not Mice Hunt, it's Mouse Hunt, who's been using this nice house as his residence. He lives on one of the walls. He has a very nice, what looks to be a comfortable bed for a mouse built out of a sardine can. And he much like I think many of us have felt when we've been renovicted from our homes in Toronto, he's not going to stand for it. He's going to fight for his house. And the mouse doesn't talk. This is a combination of Jim Henson creature effects, like puppet, and a bit of CGI. And we can talk about if the CGI, it's 97 CGI, so not so good. But when it is a Muppet, it is absolutely adorable. Think kind of like The Witches, those really great mouse effects we're getting in this film. Yeah. And unlike Mickey Mouse, he has this determination that I really am fond of. And he puts Nathan Lane, who plays one of the brothers, and remind me of his name, Lee Evans. Thank you, Lee Evans. Ripped. I did not expect Lee Evans to be that ripped. You do see him naked at one point. I was like, oh my God. But yeah. Lee Evans and Nathan Lane, just through sheer Bruegel-esque hell. And there are some amazing special effects. I shouldn't say special effects sequences, all practical, where like they've set up in the kitchen, I would say a solid 500 mouse traps.
That scene is spectacular.
It's amazing. It's like the greatest Rube Goldberg kind of mouse applied to a mouse hunt effect. And the mouse, you know, he somehow manages to like go all around the traps to get this one piece of cheese, I think it is, or cherry, and then jump up on the fridge and just drop the cherry pit so that it sets off all the traps and like they're just covered. There's so much here that I'm both like, this is the most fantastic potential for a Triscuit commercial I've ever seen. But then also it harkens back to Charlie Chaplin. There's a great sequence where Nathan Lane's character meets two Belgian hair models, which are ridiculous.
That's the most like 30s yes, thing to me. It's like, where the hell did they come up with? And it makes me like respect a strange writer filmmaker Adam Rifkin for writing a very 30s idea.
Yeah, but there's poetry in this film, and I think as much as Becky, you're like, who is this for? As an adult, I am rooting for the mouse, but I'm also happy when this film has a happy ending where like, you know, both the brothers are trying to kind of reconcile with each other, reconcile with their father's legacy, which is they're on kind of the fritz with. There's a lucky piece of string that they're fighting over, which is so Looney Tunes. It's kind of like Money Pit meets Chaplin meets Looney Tunes. And I don't know. I feel like that is a winning formula. This, and unlike Cats Don't Dance, this had a huge promotional campaign. This opened second behind Titanic,
which is wild.
This was,
I mean, I'm sure there was like a
money.
Gap.
Yes. This was it makes sense to me because Titanic is an adult film. It's like lots of kids saw it, don't get me wrong, but there wasn't much in 97 for just like families who are going to see a matinee during the Christmas holidays.
Sure.
Yeah.
The holidays in general. I shouldn't say Christmas.
That's why we saw this.
And yep. This is a Christmas film. Mm-hmm. And I think I get it. I get why this just raked in millions and millions of dollars. Even though the reviews are pretty negative and still to this day kind of negative, even though I think there's a huge reclamation that's happening with Mouse Hunt
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
This is Gore Verbinski. This is his first feature film. He got this because the script existed. You're saying the Adam Rifkin script, which must have been really phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And he got this because Katzenberg at DreamWorks, and this is the first family film that DreamWorks produced, was like, get me the guy who made the frog commercial for Budweiser at the most recent yeah. Super Bowl. Do you remember? Because when I read this, I was like, oh my God, I remember oh, yeah. that frog commercial.
Budweiser.
Yeah. It was huge.
Yeah.
It's like
that was
Gore Budweiser Verbinski. Frogs and What's Up were huge.
Yeah.
I mean, Gore Verbinski also lots of not the music videos you would think of, but like Monster Magnet
yeah.
and like NoFX music video. Like there's a certain 90s aesthetic that is Gore Verbinski music videos, especially for like pop punk era, which is kind of
I didn't
wild.
Know this about him. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Ringo and, you know, those early Pirates of the Caribbean films are fantastic. And it's like, oh, I see Gore Verbinski's trajectory here with a brilliant ad campaign to this film, which made so much money for DreamWorks on a pretty reasonable budget, to one of the biggest Disney franchises of all time. Like
you are missing the most successful Japanese to English horror translation, which is The Ring, which
I completely forgot that he did that. Wow.
It is worth saying that like, I know you guys don't like to muck around in the nightmare that is film Twitter.
No.
But there is a fairly good reclamation, because I think he's considered quite a, like, vulgar auteur, because yeah. the truth is, when you see a Gore Verbinski movie, you know it's a Gore Verbinski yeah. movie. As much as I think some people write him off as kind of like an amalgamation of Barry Sonnenfeld and Tim Burton.
There's elements yeah. of Barry Sonnenfeld
there's
and Tim Burton.
Something, yeah, and I think he actually worked with Barry
yes.
Sonnenfeld quite a
he
bit
did.
But I mean, Barry Sonnenfeld is a great cinematographer, so why not steal from him, and why not steal the great production design of Tim Burton? But yeah, he doesn't have a ton of movies. He's also seemingly maybe in director's jail. He hasn't made anything since 2016, since the very bizarre A Cure for Wellness, and yeah, so he's like, it's
Do
weird
you know
he's one of those guys that's like
he would have from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, like, I mean,
I
that's
don't
the
even
thing.
Know.
Is like,
name a number, because
he's one of these. Oh my gosh, yeah, he's one of these guys that's like, he's in director's jails, but likely richer than God. And likely is like, what jail? What? Where am I?
Yeah.
Like, who cares?
With
but
his
yeah,
beautiful
yeah, he's,
pool surrounded by many
yeah.
beautiful humans.
And
he's
I mean,
fine.
Yes, he does weird swings like the Mexican and the Weatherman, which
I like the Weatherman.
I don't think anyone loves the Mexican, but yeah, the Weatherman has a great cult following.
I believe
following.
Our,
and yeah,
our
like, yeah.
Vice President Julie Camarilla is a
I believe so.
Fan of the Weatherman.
Yes.
Hold
yes,
on, is
yes.
the Mexican the one where James Gandolfini listens to Julia Roberts pee?
No.
I think so, yes.
No.
Gandolfini and Julia Roberts, at least.
Oh, Julia Roberts, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yes, yes.
Maybe.
It's the Brad Pitt, Julia Roberts.
Yes, this is totally the movie. Yes, okay, all right, yeah, thank you.
I mean, I don't know what other movie he'd listen to or pee. But yeah, anyway, so it's like an interesting thing, because I think people, you know, he's up there with like Homemade Colette Sarah as like a guy who's making mainstream movies that people are like, this guy kind of has style that I'm into.
I mean, for a family film, there's a line where Nathan Lane is describing the mouse, and he says he's Hitler with a tail. And I'm just
Sure.
You shouldn't put that
well,
in
I mean, I also
G
think
film.
This has
why...
the weird 90s. There's a lot of sex talk,
yeah.
too.
Exactly.
There's a lot,
like yeah.
These guys do have sex and are horny.
Yes.
Which
well,
is
and
kind
Vicky,
of
Vicky Lewis, who people will remember from News
yes.
News Radio, who's one of my favorite parts of News Radio, that cursed mm-hmm. show. But she, I mean, she's fantastic mm-hmm. in this, and she plays the line between like gold digger, but like sexy and like mm-hmm. funny. Like, she knows exactly what movie
but also,
she's in.
Gold digger, but like. I get it. She's been, you know, holding down the fort in this marriage, making all the
yes.
money with this like total
oh, yeah.
bumbling
yeah.
idiot. And she's just like, God damn it, do something right.
You understand everyone around these guys.
Exactly.
These guys are like Nathan Lane is just like evil.
Yeah.
And Lee Evans is like the worst bumbling loser.
I love the fact
in a
that
weird
they
way.
Describe in the film description of this and the tagline, they're referred to as stumble bums. And that is a word
yeah,
we need to bring
it,
back because
all you can
me.
Say. Yeah. I mean, this is like the cast is crazy. I love that Mario Cantone is playing a tough guy
yeah.
who's normally known for his like broad gay acting.
Yeah. Okay. That's
yeah,
Chris. Christopher Walken. Yeah, we obviously have to talk about. He showed up, I think, for 2 days on this, and they put him on the they put him on the promotional trail, being like, "I was on set for 2 days. I thought the mouse was cute." And it's like, okay, that was
so
my Christopher Walken. Apparently,
he plays the exterminator that they bring in. He's incredibly serious, very scary. There is some physical comedy here with Walken, and he obviously the mouse wins. Let's just say the mouse wins. And they're carrying him off into the ambulance, and there is just gibberish coming out of his mouth.
Horse! Finish! I won't eat it! No.
But it's so Walken. Like, it's only Walken could do this performance. He's covered in blood. Like, as much as this is a family film, there is some real gore and some real...
Again, is this for? That's what I keep... You keep being like, as much as this is a family movie, here's all the sex. Here's all the violence.
I wonder, Becky,
here's a man eating
maybe,
half of a cockroach.
Maybe it is more of, like, a tween film. Like, it's for kids that are on the cusp, you know?
I do think that if you think about the 90s slapstick renaissance, which I think can be like credited to both Zucker Abrams and Zucker and Home Alone. But if you think of stuff like Baby's Day Out and Beethoven and Problem Child, those are weirdly mixed movies that tend to have a Charles Grodin or a John Ritter trying to have sex with a hot lady while everything else is happening, while a dog pulls all the food off the table.
Yeah.
Like, they're weird. And then there was that SNL movie boom that is pretty slapstick too, where it's like, I think it's just it is what it is at the time, and it's in some ways I think it stands out as still odd, but in other ways I'm like, that is what those movies are like, you know, like Bean is the same year.
Oh, you know my love.
I feel like
you know
Mr.
my
Bean
love.
Movie. Sure.
I love it. Sandra O's Hollywood debut.
I was gonna say Sandra O's being great, but I just remember Bean having like a horny streak and a weird violent streak.
That's a good point. There's also, I think, a certain element, just to come back to Bean. I can't put my finger on it, but there's a Britishness to this film. And Gore Verbinski's not British.
Which is also why Lee Evans is there, which I was like, I went back and I looked and I was like, Lee Evans, like, you haven't heard much of him since. And
this was a big year for him because it was Fifth Element as well.
Oh, yeah. And then something about Mary coming out afterwards. But yeah, Lee Evans is now retired, actually.
Oh.
He's only recently come out of retirement to do a few plays. But yeah, so the weird thing is Lee Evans, massive stand-up comedian in the UK.
Yeah.
He has this brief, massive A-list Hollywood career for essentially 3-4 movies. I think returns to essentially be the highest grossing comedian in the United Kingdom. If you look, he has like record-breaking sales of DVDs and stuff in the 2000s.
I had no idea.
Okay,
I watched a couple of his clips and he was actually really funny.
Okay.
Because he does a great American accent. That's part of it.
He mostly plays Americans in movies.
I'm like, there's something. I can't put my finger on it.
Yeah, the something British is Lee Evans himself. But yeah, he's a great physical comedian. I think that's part of what his act is. But yeah, the interesting thing is he retired to like spend more time with his family, and now it seems like he's just kind of coming out of it.
That's what happens when your kids leave the house and you're like, well, back to A-list movies. See you in a bit.
I think it's also like what happens when you are also richer than God.
That's
Lee
right.
Evans. It's also like, you're like, is he in actor jail? Oh no, he's just also very rich.
Yeah,
and
if
can
his,
hang out.
If, you know, that stand-up comedy, if that those are the highest grossing CDs, I notice I use the term CD, then he's
DVD.
Rolling in money.
Yeah, 100%.
Yes. In 2008, his show was the highest selling Christmas DVD in the UK, only to be surpassed by his next show in 2014.
Jeez. Okay. All right. Yeah. You know that got passed around the year before. I want to bring us back to the look of the movie, because I think that's the one thing that like I can really anchor onto. Like, we were talking about how he's kind of like got Barry Sonnenfeld. He's got Tim Burton, and obviously using William Hickey makes it very Tim Burton. But the thing that he talks about is Delicatessen and Jean-Pierre Jeunet being the look of this. And knowing that and then watching this, Delicatessen is one of my favorite movies. We'll be talking about Jean-Pierre Jeunet later when we talk about Alien 4.
Next episode,
but
I think.
Next episode. This, knowing that and looking at this, I'm like 100%. The weird angles, the up shooting, the like close-ups on facial reactions, like 100%. This is so influenced by Jeunet.
There's also a look to the house that's very like City of Lost Children, where you sense that the wallpaper glue is toxic. Like there's a haze or like a psychotropic sort of feeling to the set, where it's not just like a money pit, a house falling apart, or a house that looks like the house from Casper, the friendly ghost, the movie version. It is something that this house has its own dimension, and it almost feels like a vortex, and the mouse is in control, and I find myself completely captivated by this house. I'm also someone who lives in a house from this era that is very quickly falling apart, so I relate with very bad landlords, so I completely relate to what's going on here. Yeah, there is that. I hadn't thought about Janae, but I think you're right, Becky. There is an element there of the subversive kind of, it's like a dystopia. This film isn't meant to be a dystopia, but there's something about this house that's dystopian.
Well, it's like also everywhere they go is like filthy, which is kind of interesting. There's like dirt. The production designer is Linda Descana, who I looked up and I was like, this must have won awards for this kind of stuff. And it didn't. And it surprised me. But yeah, it's I find it very interesting. I also really like when. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So weird. I really loved the Nathan Lane talked a lot about it. And it's also interesting to like point out that Nathan Lane was like he was kind of like the heir apparent to Robin Williams at the time, because he'd done Lion King and he'd done Birdcage and was so huge and could probably do whatever he wanted.
And there's multiple Lion King references to this with Hakuna Matata.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
which is
funny.
Very strange and but fun and yeah, but he said he loved it because to him he describes it as Laurel and Hardy directed by the Coen brothers, which I feel like actually kind of works. And it weirdly, if you guys have you guys seen Crime Wave, that weird Coen's
same Coen
year
brother one.
It's very hard to one of them is Crime Wave and one is Crime Wave. It's a failure, I will say. I think that this is better than Crime Wave. Most Hunt is like a better version of Crime Wave, but it's like the Raimi and the Coens working together, and it's a slapstick noir essentially. And it's very similar, but it's interesting because I think this movie pulls it off a little better.
I love
because it's
go ahead.
No, I was like, because it's like about a mouse instead of humans killing each other.
Well, I love that Lane got the script and he was like, I don't want to do this, mostly because I look like I would be miserable shooting this because I'm a miserable person where miserable things are happening to me. And Katzenberg called him up personally and said, I want you to meet Gore Verbinski. And he goes, who? He goes, you know, the guy who does the Budweiser commercial with the frogs? He goes, yes, of course I know it. This is a direct quote. The Budweiser frogs, sure, I've seen that commercial. Not since Orson Welles has there been such a visionary. Okay, bring me to Verbinski.
I know it's meant to be glib, but it's not wrong in terms of the commercial world. Like, those commercials were...
People had those shirts, I remember.
Yeah, like, I had the froggy shirt, I think.
I love it. Right, you gotta get that back. But yeah, it's I mean, I love that. And yeah, it's kind of interesting because... But at the same time, you really get, like, this was a technological marvel.
It's
and
done.
I think that that's a thing Gore Verbinski is great for. And like you were talking about the visual stuff, like he's a very, he does jokes with the camera, which I think is a very lost art nowadays. And like, even when you talk about, they were talking about the mice, they needed 60 mice. They bred them to the specificity of Gore Verbinski. He had a look he wanted.
Oh my God.
So the mice, because I guess they reproduce fast enough. The guy's like, oh, I can get you a mouse that looks like that. So he bred 60 mice that look the same. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And to pull that off at all is crazy.
Yeah.
The most impressive bit is watching all the moving parts and thinking about how the thought process would have had to have been before it. So you think about the moment where, as you're talking about the mouse in his little like sardine tin can, just for him to like to look like this mouse is climbing into this little tin can in his little house that he's decorated.
He has a little calendar and like things on the wall.
He has a sense of aesthetics.
He wants to go to Hawaii.
Hawaii poster, that's right.
Totally, but then you think of that, like you watch the mouse go in and like all like the cuts that they're doing, which they have to do obviously because getting the mouse to do what they need it to do trick-wise, but then when it starts to like run through the halls and you're watching the nails go through, like it's wild.
The nail gun
That nail gun is crazy because it's obviously seamless. Sometimes it's CGI.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's an animatronic mouse head.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a mouse that's trained, and it's pretty seamless.
I agree.
Yeah.
For 97, like looking at something like Alien 3, well, like Alien 3 being the first like CGI kind of dog, it looks
it's
atrocious.
Rough. It's rough.
And yes, Alien 4, next episode, Resurrection, we're going to talk about that mix of animatronics and CGI and like how bad the CGI looks because the animatronics look amazing. I'm pretty impressed by this film, by Mouse Hunt, like in terms of, you know, it's not the same budget as, well, maybe it was, there must have been a high budget on this. I can't remember. I mean, Katzenberg.
There must have been,
because this started a bidding war. So basically like 20th Century Fox was in the bid, Warner Bros. Was in the bid, Disney was in the bid, and Katzenberg, who had just left Disney and was, you know, now firmly with DreamWorks, was like, I'm going to fuck with all these dudes and I highlight dudes because they're all dudes, and like drive up the bidding like crazy, like as though it's, you know, a house in Rosedale, and just like inflate the price and then buy it because I can.
And, are you ready for the numbers? I have the numbers. Okay, so $38 million budget.
That's low. I mean, so Alien Resurrection is 78, so that's half.
Yeah, so that's impressive. Worldwide gross, just theatrically, $122 million.
Yeah, and if you look at it probably now, because I know, much like the Alien movies we're talking about, the DVD sales on this and rentals and things like that, family films at Blockbuster are, you know, this was probably more in the $200 million range on a 38 investment. I mean, this would have probably been excerpted somehow for television for airlines. I'm so curious to see what they cut out of that. And there's a lot of boobs in this film for its rating. But
again, but that's what I'm saying. These 90s movies, they loved boobs.
Boobs and big hair. Yeah.
All right. I think that's where we need to end this episode. So Cameron Maitland, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Oh, thank you guys. And yeah, I mean, check out, like I say, Trudy Styles, The Sweatbox has technically been purchased and suppressed by Disney, but you know, Google around and you might be able to find it.
I am looking for this right now because it sounds great. Thank you. Up my alley. Alicia Fletcher, was this everything you'd hoped for?
It was really fun. And one thing we haven't mentioned, and this is so important, is that Mouse Hunt is coming to Hollywood Suite.
Yay!
And you can watch it on Hollywood Suite around the time that this episode is going to air. And that means I got my way. So someone finally indulged me. I had to, you know, lose some battles to win this one. It's the most important battle. And I have one more thing. I don't want the studio to sue me or anything, but like, if you turn your TV to only be black and white, which I have done for this film, incredible. Watch this, like, first, if you've never seen it, watch it the way it's meant to be seen on Hollywood Suite. Then if you have the right TV, turn all the saturation down and make it black and white, and holy moly, it is the Orson Welles.
Like, this feels like your like Dark Side of the Moon meets the Wizard of Oz kind of moment here. Alicia, thank you so much for bringing
this to us. Thank you.
All right. And you can join us next week, where we're headed to the place where no one can hear you scream. However, there's going to be a lot of screaming on these spooky spaceships. We're looking at Alien 4 Resurrection and Event Horizon. And we'll have special guest Robin Citizen, PhD, with us. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Alicia Fletcher and Cameron Maitland as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagné. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Camaria. Creative consultant was Ryan Mains. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.